But right now we're going to be going through Daniel chapters 10 through 12. So it's a remarkably detailed prophecy right in chapter 11 of the book of Daniel. This prophecy is so detailed that it's led many to doubt the time of writing of the book. It's one of those contributory factors to why people are so desirous of proving that Daniel was not written when it claims it was written. By the way, what you're being handed out now is the replacement second sheet from yesterday with the numbers in the right sequence. Okay, so just tear up what you had yesterday and just throw it away. It'll avoid any confusion. Gary.
I just wanted to mention that my wife and I were this year at a conference for the New England Teachers Police Association, and we had a speaker come in that was at the World Trade Center. When everything came down, he was one of the unseen crime investigating unit people in charge of the crime scene, and barely escaped with his life. And one of the things he said in his presentation was that Al-Qaeda units are operating in every state. And I come from New Hampshire and Vermont. He says there are two or three. He could tell us how many Al-Qaeda operational units there were in the state of New Hampshire. But just because we're not hearing about it, it's very, very active and very much part of what the intelligence community knows is happening. And they're recruiting all the time. They're recruiting in New York City, Vermont.
I referred to something in the latest World News and Prophecy. I've written an article on how Islam is threatening freedom of speech. Paul Harvey got himself into deep trouble in December over a comment he made, and Britain's equivalent of Oprah Winfrey was forced off the air because of comments that he made. The comments that both Paul Harvey and the other man, Robert Kilroy Silk, made were both accurate. But political correctness says that you can't say these things. So therefore, you know, they both suffer the consequences. But one of the things I bring out in the article is that, and this is according to Islamic sources themselves, 80% of the mosques in the U.S. are under the leadership of imams who are Wahhabis. And the Wahhabi sect of Islam, which comes from Saudi Arabia, is the most militant of all forms of Islam. And what we're finding is the reverse of the American experience is taking place here. Whereas in the past, immigrants would come from other countries, and usually by the second generation, they were absorbed into America. The second generation of Muslims is actually the exact opposite. The hatred of America is intense. And of course, they're in every single state, as Gary just mentioned. And this is something which portends ill for the future. But it's something that we need to realize is very much the case. But again, you can't say it. If you say it, then you'll find that freedom of speech does not extend into certain areas. But anyway, like I said, we will come to some of these things as we continue through these classes. But right now, let's get into the book of Daniel again. And like I said, Daniel 11 is the main prophetic chapter that we're going to be looking at. But we're going to start in chapter 10. The prophecy that you're going to be hearing today expounds on chapter 8, this time in minute detail. Remember, we went through chapters 8 and 9 yesterday, but now we get a more detailed version of chapter 8, just as chapter 7 expounded on chapter 2. And, you know, in the same way, God reveals a little here, a little there, and then later on you get more revealed to you, and that's the way we grow as Christians. Our understanding increases in time. And in the same way, these visions revealed more as time went on. Now, notice a contrast, though, because in chapter 8 and verse 27, Daniel said, "I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it." That was chapter 8 and verse 27. Now we see in verse 11 here of chapter 10, the opposite is true. The angel is saying, "O Daniel, man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak to you." So understand now, you see, whereas before no one understood. And then in verse 14, "Now I have come to make you understand what will happen to your people in the latter days." So here, Daniel's mind was being opened to greater understanding. The timing of this prophecy is given in chapter 10 and verse 1. It says, "In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, who conquered Babylon in 539 B.C., and ruled until his death in 530. So the third year is 537, 536. Again, remember, They didn't do their years from January to December like we do. So that's the timing of this particular prophecy. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, so remember this is 2 years then after Cyrus's decree, which said that the Jews should go back to Jerusalem. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel, whose name was called Belteshazzar. It's interesting, too, that his name was still Belteshazzar. You know, he was given that name by the Babylonians, by the Chaldeans, after their god. Now the Persians had taken over, but he still is called here Belteshazzar. The message was true, but the appointed time was long. If you look in your margin, it says, and of great conflict. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown translates this as great calamity. The message was true, but the appointed time was long. Continual conflict. I mentioned yesterday that if you look at history, there have always been wars going on. Just because we may have, at certain times, some peace, doesn't mean that there is peace everywhere else. You know, most of the world, if you take the world as a whole, there's always some conflict going on somewhere, and that's generally been the case throughout history. But even with the people of Israel, you look at the history of Israel, and not just the Jewish people, but all the tribes of Israel, and again, you know, you look at history, and it's just never-ending conflict. The message was true, but the appointed time was long. And he understood the message, and had understanding of the vision. In those days, I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks. He was fasting, afflicting himself by fasting for a whole 3 weeks here. I ate no pleasant food, no meat or wine came into my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all, till 3 whole weeks were fulfilled. When it says I ate no pleasant food, that is referring to eating unleavened bread. Again, you see that in commentaries that he was eating unleavened bread. And that ties in with verse 4, because verse 4 says, now on the 24th day of the first month, the month of Nisan, you know, the time for the Passover and the days of unleavened bread, the month which reminded Daniel of Israel's captivity in Egypt. So, you know, knowing that this decree had been issued that the Jews should go back to Jerusalem, but there were probably delays, and maybe there were some people at court, you know, who objected to them being let go because they were needed, perhaps, in the positions that they were already in. You know, the Jews are quite a productive people and very competent people. And the economy, obviously, in the area that had been Babylon was probably dependent on them. So, you know, some people would have opposed them going. But Daniel felt that this was a time when he should be fasting and asking for God's intervention to make sure that everything went all right. So on the 24th day of the first month, as I was by the side of the great river, that is the Tigris, I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, a certain man clothed in linen, whose waist was girded with gold of Uphaz. His body was like beryl, his face like the appearance of lightning, his eyes like torches of fire, his arms and feet like burnished bronze in color, and the sound of his words like the voice of a multitude. This is most probably Jesus Christ. Gabriel was mentioned in chapter 8 and verse 14. If you have a look there, it says chapter 8. In chapter 8 he's mentioned, and again in chapter 9 and verse 21, while I was speaking in prayer, the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in a vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly. Yeah, chapter 8 and verse 16 is what I was looking for. I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, who called and said, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. And when it mentions Gabriel, there is no description given of him in those two passages, okay? Here, it doesn't say Gabriel, and there is a vivid description, a very colorful description given here. And the description is very similar to what we see in Revelation chapter 1. If you want to turn there for a moment and just have a look at chapter 1, beginning in verse 10. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a loud voice as of a trumpet, saying, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, and what you see write in a book and send it to the 7 churches which are in Asia. Verse 12, and I turned to see the voice that spoke with me, and having turned, I saw 7 golden lampstands. And in the midst of the 7 lampstands, one like the Son of Man, clothed with a garment down to the feet, and girded about the chest with a golden band. His head and his hair were white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes like a flame of fire. His feet were like fine brass, as if refined in a furnace, and his voice as the sound of many waters. He had in his right hand seven stars, and so on. So a very similar description there to what we see in Daniel chapter 10. I lifted my eyes from the ground, you know, while mourning. I lifted my eyes and looked, and that's what he saw. Then in verse 7, and I, Daniel, alone saw the vision. For the men who were with me did not see the vision, but a great terror fell upon them, so that they fled to hide themselves. When they realized they were in the presence of something supernatural, they were frightened and they ran away. Therefore I was left alone when I saw this great vision, and no strength remained in me, for my vigor was turned to frailty in me, and I retained no strength. I'm sure that's largely because he'd been fasting for 3 weeks, but also, again, you know, just all the visions he had had and the revelations that had been given to him of what was going to befall his people had left him just physically drained. Yet I heard the sound of his words, and while I heard the sound of his words, I was in a deep sleep on my face, with my face to the ground. He sank into a deep sleep, and that's when this vision was revealed to him. Then suddenly a hand touched me, which made me tremble on my knees and on the palms of my hands. And he said to me, O Daniel, man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak to you and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you. While he was speaking this word to me, I stood trembling. Then he said to me, do not fear, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come because of your words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days, 3 weeks, the same 3 week period that Daniel had been fasting, had been in great mourning. The prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. And behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I had been left alone there with the kings of Persia. Now, this is a very interesting verse, because what it shows us is that there is an angel for the kingdom of Persia, and later on we see also an angel for the kingdom of Greece and an angel for Israel. Now, the angel of the Persian kings tried to stop Gabriel from going to Daniel. He wanted the restoration of the Jewish people delayed. I think we can deduce from this that the angels of the Gentile empires are you know, from the other side, so to speak, demonic forces. Look at Revelation chapter 13, and you can understand this a little bit more when you look at Revelation chapter 13, where here it talks about these beast powers. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. So a composite of the three first beasts of Daniel chapter 7. And the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. Go back to chapter 12 and verse 9. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. And remember, these Gentile empires all impacted the nation of Israel negatively to one degree or another. Some were far more cruel than others were, far more despotic. But they all, you know, had a major impact upon the Israelites. And down through history in the last 2,000 years, the fourth beast has had a major impact upon spiritual Israel, because of the persecution that has come upon God's true people from false religion. And it is Satan that is behind these forces. So when we realize there is a struggle going on in the world between different powers, we need to understand that there may be, and likely is, even some sort of a spiritual struggle, something going on in the spirit world as well, especially if the Israelites are impacted by something. So now we come to verse 14. Well, no, let's still be in verse 13, I'm sorry. The prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days, and behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me. So Gabriel needed the help of one of the other archangels, and Michael came to help him. It's interesting, in chapter 12 of Daniel and verse 1, what it says about Michael. At that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. So it looks as if Michael has special responsibility for the people of God, for the people of Israel. In fact, if you go to the end of chapter 10 as well, there's a reference to Michael there in verse 21. In parentheses, it says, "No one upholds me against these except Michael, your prince." So Michael's responsibility is to protect Israel. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown makes this comment: "To him alone of the angels, the office of protecting Israel, in concert with the angelic speaker," that's Gabriel in this case, "was delegated. All the world powers were against Israel," which is kind of interesting because we're moving into that again now, that situation, where all the world powers are against Israel. And I mean Israel in its wider context. I don't mean the Jews in the Middle East. All the world's against the Jews in the Middle East. But also the U.S. and Britain and Australia. You know, you're seeing that now as the nations are against, you know, what is happening in those countries. So in verse 14, "Now I've come to make you understand what will happen to your people in the latter days. For the vision refers to many days yet to come." So the prophecy here is not just about Antiochus Epiphanes, but also includes end time events that precede Christ's second coming. Antiochus Epiphanes is a type of what lies ahead. Remember, Antiochus Epiphanes was the Seleucid monarch that desecrated the temple in 168-167 BC, and he was a type of what lies ahead. "When he had spoken such words to me, I turned my face toward the ground and became speechless." He was struck dumb, overwhelmed in humble reverence just by this whole thing. I think, you know, we could, you know, have a similar reaction in the same circumstances. "I was struck dumb, and suddenly one having the likeness of the sons of men touched my lips." Now again, it's a change of person here, a change of being here from Gabriel, okay? "One having the likeness of the sons of men touched my lips. Then I opened my mouth and spoke, saying to him who stood before me, 'My Lord, because of the vision, my sorrows have overwhelmed me, and I have retained no strength.'" It's interesting, if you look at Mark chapter 7, you see here that Jesus Christ healed somebody who was deaf in exactly the same way. Mark chapter 7, you just turn there for a moment. Read this account in verses 31 through 35. "Again, departing from the region of Tyre and Sidon, he came through the midst of the region of Decapolis to the Sea of Galilee. Then they brought to him one who was deaf and had an impediment in his speech, and they begged him to put his hand on him. And he took him aside from the multitude and put his fingers in his ears, and he spat and touched his tongue. Then looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, 'Ephphatha, that is, be opened.' Immediately his ears were opened, and the impediment of his tongue was loosed, and he spoke plainly." So again, you know, the same Jesus Christ here as well in Daniel 10, verse 16. "Suddenly, one having the likeness of the sons of men touched my lips," and he was able to speak again. So in verse 17, "For how can this servant of my Lord talk with you, my Lord? As for me, no strength remains in me now, nor is any breath left in me. Then again, the one having the likeness of a man touched me and strengthened me." So now we're back to Gabriel again. "And he said, 'O man greatly beloved, fear not. Peace be to you. Be strong. Yes, be strong.' So when he spoke to me, I was strengthened and said, 'Let my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me.' Then he said, 'Do you know why I have come to you? And now I must return to fight with the prince of Persia. And when I've gone forth, indeed the prince of Greece will come.' So when the angel of the prince of Persia is defeated, then the angel of the prince of Greece will come. It never ends. One conflict after another. Before the time of Jesus Christ, it was one attempt after another to destroy the physical nation of Israel. But, you know, since that time, not only have there been attempts to destroy the physical people of Israel, but also the spiritual people of Israel. But demonic forces are always going after the people of God, whether physical or spiritual, and today, you know, even both, to thwart God's plan and to stop God working with Israel. But I will tell you what is noted in the scripture of truth. That's an expression meaning these things will surely come to pass. No one upholds me against these except Michael, your prince. Also in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. Notice the end of the parentheses here is at the end of verse 1 here. In the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. And now I will tell you the truth. So now we read in greater detail the events prophesied in chapter 8, the conquest of Persia by Alexander the Great, and then subsequent events. I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. This is the king called Xerxes, X-E-R-X-E-S. Xerxes was the fourth king. His riches were proverbial. Persia reached its climax and showed its greatest power in its invasion of Greece in 480 BC. But he lost. Now, that doesn't mean that Persia no longer existed. You can lose a war and still exist as a nation. But obviously, if you lose a war, your credibility is going to suffer considerably, and other nations are not going to fear you in the same way. I think we're already experiencing that with what's happening in Iraq, for example. You know, and the same thing was true with the Persians. So they went into a terminal decline after their defeat against Greece in 480 BC. So Persia, from that point on, was no longer very important, though it still existed until Alexander's time. Xerxes' descendants are so unimportant, they get no mention here. And the chapter leaps after this, 150 years, right down to the time of Alexander the Great, who was the next monarch of consequence. But let's carry on reading. Now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all, Xerxes. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. So Xerxes went and attacked Greece. Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. So this is Alexander the Great. Now, between verse 2 and verse 3, you've got almost 150 years. Now remember, Daniel does give us the overview of history. Remember, God looks at history differently to the way we do, because to him, 1,000 years is but a day. So 150 years is nothing. Remember, too, that in the ancient world, things moved a lot slower. So the rise and fall of nations was tended to, you know, take longer than it does today. Today, a nation can fall literally in seconds. I mean, we could have a major financial crisis, and because of the internet today, and because of, you know, communications the way that they are, you know, we could collapse in you know, literally seconds or minutes anyway. So it's very different to the way things were back then. When he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, because he had no heirs. So Alexander himself, you know, his heirs, his children did not take over, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled. When it says not according to his dominion, that means that when the kingdom was divided, nobody got the same territory that Alexander had conquered, because it was all divided into four. For his kingdom shall be uprooted even for others besides these. So others would benefit from it. Now, it took about 20 years for this division to be accomplished, because initially you just had three divisions. But in verse 5, we see something prophesied. And notice this. Now, I don't expect anybody to go away and remember all the things that happen here in chapter 11. Nobody could do that. I mean, I have to look at it, you know, every time I go through this and go over it again, because there were so many kings mentioned and so many daughters and mothers and wives, and you know, it gets very difficult and very technical, very detailed. What is important, this is what you go away with, okay, is that this is a very detailed prophecy, and it was fulfilled accurately hundreds of years after it was revealed to Daniel. That is the important thing to realize. Now, we're going to go through it, because everybody has to go through it once in their lifetime. And your chosen day is today, okay? But I assure you, we're not going to have a test on Tuesday where I ask you all the king's names and everything else. And, you know, just understand that the importance is the fulfilled prophecy. That's what is important here. Plus the fact, and this is of also great importance, is that not everything in it has yet been fulfilled. Although most has, actually. Most of the verses in chapter 11 were fulfilled in the ancient world, but there is still some left. So, the king of the south shall become strong, as well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. Now remember, I showed you the map of the Greek Empire a couple of days ago, and when you look at the map of the Greek Empire, you see that the Greek Empire was divided up and after Alexander the Great died, and you had Seleucus ended up with the part of the empire that was north of Jerusalem in what is now Syria. We would call it Syria. And it extended considerably east, right to Afghanistan, part of Afghanistan, part of India. And then to the south of Israel, you had Egypt under Ptolemy. Those are the two important kings that we need to look at here. And that's what this prophecy is about, because they impacted the Jewish people, because Judah was caught in the middle. Okay, Judah was in a bad neighborhood, so to speak, at the time, with these two kings, one on either side of them. The others are not important, but initially Ptolemy had taken a much bigger area, and it wasn't until about 20 years later that Seleucus really established himself as a separate kingdom to the north. And we see this prophesied here. Then the king of the south shall become strong, as well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. What happened was that Ptolemy the first of Egypt became very strong, as this verse prophesied, developing Egypt into a rich and powerful nation again. Then one of his generals, a man called Seleucus Nicator, also became very strong. In 312 BC, he took advantage while Ptolemy was away fighting a war and established himself as king, completing the four divisions. And the whole thing was not really completely complete until a few years after this as well. So you ended up with Ptolemy ruling over Egypt, part of Syria and Judea. Seleucus, who had most of Syria, Babylonia, and the territory east to India. Lysimachus, who had Asia Minor, what we would now call Turkey. And Cassander, who was the general who took Greece and Macedonia, where they had all originally come from. But please note that from this point on, the prophecy follows the first two of these divisions, as they have a direct bearing on the people of Judah. So the king of the south is talking about the Ptolemaic dynasty of Egypt. And the king of the north is the Seleucid dynasty, descended from Seleucus. I might just mention as an aside here that when Alexander conquered Egypt in the 4th century BC, Egypt was not to be ruled again by a native until 1952. In my lifetime. So that's how long Egypt came under foreign domination of one sort or another. It wasn't the same domination for the whole period of time, but they didn't have a native ruler again until 1952. So, that just gives you an idea as to what kind of things were happening. So now we come to verse 6, and at the end of some years they shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of her authority, and neither he nor his authority shall stand. But she shall be given up with those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. Now, this was fulfilled about 50 years later in 252 BC, when Bernice, the daughter of Ptolemy Philadelphus, married Antiochus II of Syria. Now, this has been typical in history, that two kings will arrange an alliance, and the daughter of one will marry the son of another, which cements the alliance. And sometimes even, if there are no other heirs, two nations can actually be united into a bigger kingdom or a bigger empire. That's the way things have been done throughout most of history. And so here there was an arranged marriage between Bernice, the daughter of Ptolemy Philadelphus, who was the king of Egypt, and she married Antiochus II of Syria. The only problem was that Antiochus was already married to Laodice or Laodice. When Ptolemy Philadelphus died, Antiochus got rid of his wife and returned to Laodice, who in turn had both of them murdered. So again, these kind of intrigues are They're what makes politics so interesting sometimes, these things that go on. He that begat her, as it says here, her father also died. All three died rapidly. So again, fulfilled exactly as it says, and it was fulfilled around the year 252, I should say, and in subsequent years after that as well. So we're talking now about, we're talking almost 300 years after this vision, and it was fulfilled exactly. And then in verse 7, but from a branch of her roots one shall arise in his place, who shall come with an army, enter the fortress of the king of the north, and deal with them and prevail. Out of a shoot of her roots. Well, Bernice, who was murdered, remember, by Laodice, Antiochus II's first wife, was avenged by her brother, the next Ptolemy, Euergetes III, who invaded Syria as far as the Euphrates and killed Laodice. So he avenged her. Now this means, keep in mind, the Holy Land changed hands. Remember, all these invasions, alliances, intrigues affected the Jews who were caught in the middle. Verse 8, and he shall also carry their gods captive to Egypt with their princes and their precious articles of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. Again, this was fulfilled as prophesied. Upon hearing of sedition in Egypt, he seized the fortress of Syria, Seleucia, later the port of Antioch, the capital, taking immense booty, including 40,000 talents of silver and 2,500 molten images and idolatrous vessels stolen from Egypt in 526 by Cambyses. So even, 300 years later, the Egyptians still wanted this property returned, which had been taken 300 years ago. The Egyptians were so grateful, they gave him the title Euergetes, which means benefactor. So this is Ptolemy Euergetes III. He survived Seleucus by 4 years. He died in 222. Seleucus, the king of the north, had died earlier in 226. So again, fulfilling the last part of that verse, he shall continue more years than the king of the north. Very exact, very detailed. Then the king of the north shall come to the kingdom of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. A clearer translation of this verse is, then he for several years shall desist from contending with the king of the north, who was dead. Seleucus had died 4 years earlier. He returned to Egypt with great spoil. However, in verse 10, his sons shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. His sons, Seleucus' two sons, then became king in turn. Seleucus III only reigned for 3 years, 226 to 223 BC. After his death, following a fall from his horse, his brother Antiochus III, Antiochus the Great in history, became king until 187 BC. And it says, one shall certainly come, that is, one of the two brothers, one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. After 27 years, Antiochus took back the fortress captured by Ptolemy Euergetes III. He also conquered Syria as far as Gaza in the south, which included Judea. One thing you get from this passage as well, this whole chapter, is the pointlessness of most war. Because, here, vast armies go and clash, and one takes this fortress, and then 30 years later, the other side comes back and takes the fortress again. Or one takes spoil, and the other side comes back, 300 years later and takes spoil again. And it's like, it just goes on like this, on and on, just fighting over territory. And it just emphasizes the pointlessness of most conflict. Verse 11, and the king of the south shall be moved with rage and go out and fight with him, with the king of the north, who shall muster a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into the hand of his enemy. So all of this provoked Ptolemy IV, the king of the south, Egypt. You realize we're moving slowly down now, generations. Ptolemy IV, so this is the fourth king of the Ptolemaic dynasty. king of the south, Ptolemy Philopater, he was called. He raised an army of 20,000 and defeated Antiochus, killed tens of thousands, and again annexed Judea in the process. So again, you note just how Judea is constantly being fought over, changing hands. Now realize, imagine what that does too. You know, when a nation changes hands, it's not just a case of, it's not like when the president changes here. I mean, if you're not interested in politics here and you don't even care who the president is, you don't really notice any change from one administration to the next. It can take years before there's any visible change or any perceptive change. But, you know, here you're talking about as soon as one army takes over. I mean, first of all, they probably destroy a lot of buildings as they come through your city. And maybe in all the chaos, there's no food available. And maybe all the agricultural produce gets trampled by the military. So as a result of food shortages, your prices go up. Or maybe if the food shortages are severe, a lot of people end up starving. Starvation often leads to diseases, which can wipe out lots of people again. Your money changes immediately because the new rulers do not recognize the previous currency. So, you know, the money changes again. I mean, we're talking here about massive upheaval every time these changes take place. And remember, you know, in Daniel chapter 9, in the 70 weeks prophecy, it used that expression, in troublesome times. You know, this is a long period of continual upheaval. Not every day, but, you know, regularly throughout this long period of time. And we've lived in a similar time ourselves, except that the United States and Britain, Canada and so on, have been spared for much of this over the past 60 years. But if you look at Africa, for example, a third of the countries of Africa are involved in conflicts right now. And even the other two-thirds have had all kinds of upheavals with coups and revolutions and things during the past 40 or 50 years. So other parts of the world often have continual conflict. So now we come to verse 12. We saw in verse 11 how Ptolemy the Fourth had defeated Antiochus and annexed Judea. And then, of course, this went to his head. It says in verse 12, when he has taken away the multitude, its heart will be lifted up. It went to his head. And he will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. You know, when he became cocky, in other words, he thought that he was really great and that he could do anything. Instead of following up his victory by conquering the whole of Syria, he made peace with Antiochus and then turned to licentiousness, self-indulgence, thereby losing all he had gained in his victory. He will not prevail. Having gained the advantage, he did not stick with it. So eventually it all went against him. For the king of the north will return and muster a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come at the end of some years with a great army and much equipment. 12 years later, Ptolemy the Fourth died, leaving the throne to his infant son, Ptolemy Epiphanes. Antiochus took the opportunity to hit back and won. And then in verse 14, and in those times many shall rise up against the king of the south. Also certain violent men of your people shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision, but they shall fall. So, you know, here with Antiochus hitting back with the new Ptolemy, Ptolemy Epiphanes in power, you know, a child obviously would not be ruling, so there would be some sort of an advisory council or a regent or something. But the country was still weakened by this change in administration. And Antiochus took advantage of that. And, of course, perceiving weakness, a lot of people rebelled against the Ptolemies at this time. In those times, many shall rise up against the king of the south. Also, certain violent men of your people, referring to the Jewish people. In fact, in the margin, that the expression violent men is translated robbers. Those who are seeking personal advantage, financial gain, you get that in all political chaos. Those who think they can make money out of it will do so because they don't have any loyalties whatsoever except to themselves. And you've always got that in any society, in any nation. Also, certain violent men of your people shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision. But they shall fall. They won't succeed. So the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city. And the forces of the south shall not withstand him. Even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist. Scopas, the Egyptian general, met Antiochus at Peneus near the sources of the Jordan and was defeated, and fled to Sidon, a strongly fortified city, where he was forced to surrender by Antiochus's forces. So again, this is a fulfillment exactly of this particular verse. Verse 16, but he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one shall stand against him. He shall stand in a glorious land with destruction in his power. So this is Antiochus coming against Ptolemy Epiphanes. Antiochus could do what he wanted, including getting his own way with the Holy Land. But he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one shall stand against him. He shall stand in a glorious land with destruction in his power. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, that she shall not stand with him or be for him. You know, it's very complicated, isn't it? Well, it seems very complicated, but again, it's fulfilled exactly historically. Instead of invading Ptolemy's country at once with his whole strength, his plan is to give to Ptolemy Epiphanes his daughter Cleopatra in marriage, not the Elizabeth Taylor Cleopatra. She was later on. That Cleopatra was a queen in her own right. I might just explain here for a moment monarchy, because America's a republic, and sometimes it's a little difficult for people on this side of the Atlantic to understand it. But generally speaking, and this is true in most monarchies, the eldest son inherits the throne. Now, the only time a woman inherits the throne is if there is no boy, if there is no male. So Queen Elizabeth, for example, in Britain, inherited the throne because there was no male child. She was the eldest of two daughters. But now when a king marries a woman, she is a queen, but she has no power. But Queen Elizabeth is a queen in her own right. In other words, she is the reigning monarch. So, you know, we need to understand that. Cleopatra was a reigning monarch. She was queen as a ruling queen, whereas most queens are simply queens because they're married to the king, and they don't have any power in that case. Now, when you have a queen, as in Queen Elizabeth, for example, her husband has no power whatsoever, and he simply has the title of Prince Philip. Or in Holland, you've got Prince Henry, I think it is, who's married to Queen Beatrix. So, you know, that explains it there. So this is not talking about, you know, the Cleopatra that came later on, who was the last of the Ptolemaic dynasty. And she was the one, if you remember, who came up at the time of Julius Caesar and Mark Antony and all the intrigues that were going on at that time, just prior to the first coming of Jesus Christ at that time period. So let's look at verse 17 again. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Instead of invading Ptolemy's country with his whole strength, his plan is to give to Ptolemy Epiphanes his daughter Cleopatra in marriage, because the marriage between two dynasties ends conflict and leads to an alliance. And this is why kings arrange marriages for their daughters. You know, daughters are tradable, I guess. You know, you trade a daughter for an alliance, and you know, you lose a daughter, but it saves a lot of conflict, saves a lot of war. The aim is to secure Egypt's neutrality while he goes to war with the new power of Rome, hoping to acquire more territory. So, you know, he wants peace in the south because he's now going to go to war with Rome, which is up in the north and to the west. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. That, if you look in the margin, means bring equitable terms, a marriage proposal, alliance. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it. That was his daughter Cleopatra. But she shall not stand with him or be for him. So his own daughter ended up backing her new husband against her father. These things happen. After this, he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall take many. He took many of the islands in the Aegean. He was finally routed by the Roman general Lucius Scipio Asiaticus, who routed his forces at Magnesia in 190 BC. Again, a fulfillment of this prophecy. But a ruler shall bring the reproach against them to an end. And with the approach removed, he shall turn back on him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. So having faced defeat against the Roman general, he then turned his attention closer to home, but was killed in battle 3 years later. In verse 20, there shall arise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom. So one who taxed the Jews heavily. But within a few days he should be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle. Again, fulfilled exactly. He was succeeded by his son, Seleucus Philopater, who sent his tax collector, Heliodorus, to tax the Jews. Heliodorus later poisoned him in 176 BC. He left no son to take his place, so his tax collector turned around and poisoned him. There shall arise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle. He was poisoned. Again, just note the accuracy of this prophecy, an incredibly detailed prophecy which was fulfilled exactly as it says. And in his place shall arise a vile person, verse 21, to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. So his younger brother, Antiochus IV, named Epiphanes, took the throne, ousting Heliodorus. And he astonishes his subjects by being more Roman than the Romans. So verse 21, he's described as a vile person, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. So he had to somehow establish his authority, and you know that was done with a great deal of intrigue. With the force of a flood, remember how this can symbolize a great military force, because you know if you look down from a plane at you know a considerable height, you know when you see a lot of people, it seems like a wave of people, like a sea. And in this vision, you know, a flood is like a military force. With the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. Now, this does not refer to Jesus Christ. Antiochus attempted to replace the high priest with one who was more subservient to him. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. He shall enter peaceably, even into the richest places of the province. And he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches. And he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. He shall do what his fathers have not done. His ancestors dealt kindly with the Jews, but now Antiochus was driving them to desperation with some of his mad projects. In verse 25, he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. So further war between the kings of the north and south took place as Ptolemy Philometor tries to take territory promised as part of the dowry of Cleopatra, the late queen mother. Ptolemy loses, betrayed by some of his own generals, as we see here. Yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacy shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. Both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table. But it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. Now what happened was this: Antiochus captured Ptolemy at a banquet in 174 BC. He pretended to ally himself with Ptolemy against his brother, but each was deceiving the other. Again, a fulfillment of this prophecy, exactly as it says. Now verse 28, and after verse 28 we'll take a break. It's a convenient stop here. While returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the Holy Covenant. So he shall do damage and return to his own land. So returning to Syria from Egypt, victorious and with great plunder, he sets himself against the Jews, massacring thousands and stealing golden vessels from the temple at Jerusalem. Let's have a break for a few minutes here, and if I can borrow our resident computer expert, I would appreciate it.